We'll start today by talking about immigration and the crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. We've been reporting on the surge of illegal border crossings, particularly of unaccompanied children. And we're talking about how federal authorities have been scrambling to shelter these would-be migrants and meet the demands of the law for evaluating each person's circumstances. Now, citizens in some of the places that federal officials were planning to use to relieve overcrowding at border facilities are resisting those efforts. Last week, hundreds of residents stood on the road in Murrieta, California, blocking a bus convoy of immigrants and forcing it to turn around. Protests continue there this weekend. We wanted to hear more about all this and what it could mean for the national immigration debate, so we've called upon Tatiana Sanchez. She's a reporter with the Desert Sun in Southern California. She covers immigration and has been reporting on the protests. Also with us once again is Dallas Morning News staff writer Diane Solis, who's covering immigration in Texas. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
So let me play a clip from Murrieta Mayor Alan Long, who spoke to CNN's State of the Union program yesterday.
We didn't have a lot of answers early on, and there were some legitimate concerns, health concerns, and humane concerns. People were concerned about the people, the immigrants coming here. Would they have proper facilities? Who's going to take care of them? How long is this going to be for? And those were questions that we just didn't get any answers to.
Tatiana, can you pick up the thread? I heard people yelling USA, USA, so I'm not really sure that I can hear what their concerns were. What did they tell you?
Yeah, USA chants are a lot of what I heard on the ground, especially on July 4th. There was a lot of flag waving and USA chanting, and that was mostly coming from anti-immigrant protesters. What their concerns are, aside from the fact that they say that these people are crossing the border illegally and do not have a right to be here, they have a lot of health concerns, in particular for their children. They say, well, how can we be assured that these people, you know, are not going to bring any diseases or pose health concerns to our children? They're also concerned about their local resources being drained, and they say, well, everyone is talking about these undocumented children that are coming into our area, but what about our own children that, you know, are going to go to school potentially with these kids, or that are going to show up at the doctor's office? So they're really worried about, you know, their local resources being drained.
So then when the bus, after it was turned away from Murrieta, California, it went to El Centro, California. Was the response the same there, or was it different?
You know, the group that went to El Centro was actually, interestingly enough, a completely different batch of undocumented immigrants. So what's going on is there are buses that are being transported both to El Centro and to the San Diego area in Murrieta. So the welcome, I don't want to say welcoming, but the buses actually literally came in a matter of minutes with no protesters in sight, no family members in sight. It was actually very quiet and a drastically different scene from what we saw in Murrieta. So I saw the buses roll in El Centro on Wednesday, and the families were unloaded from the bus very quickly.
Any sense about why the reaction was so different?
Yeah, I mean, I think demographics definitely come into play. El Centro sits just a few minutes from the border and is a highly immigrant town. It's not strange at all to see people coming in from the border, from Mexico, you know, predominantly Latino community. And quite frankly, the El Centro Border Patrol Station is equipped. It has a processing center, so it is equipped to do these sorts of things and to process these undocumented immigrants, whereas the station in Murrieta is predominantly used to process criminals, you know, found with drugs and things of that sort. So I think that definitely has something to do with it. It's the demographics of the city is that it's a highly Latino immigrant town just a few minutes from the border. So this was, for them, you know, seemingly ordinary.
Dan, what about you? Well, you've been covering this for some time in many, many dimensions. This question of people coming out of the street and protesting the movement of migrants, have you seen that in Texas where you are?
We haven't seen that yet, but we may tomorrow when this issue is taken before the Dallas County Commissioner's Court. Up till now, what we've seen is really rather extraordinary compassion, and the county judge, Clay Jenkins, leading the effort, saying that these are people, not problems. and that it's his own 8-year-old daughter who told him, "Dad, you got to do something." Mm. And he did. He began the effort to look for sites that could house up to 2,000 juveniles temporarily. That is in the vetting process right now with the federal government.
So that's the report. There's a report that Dallas County is considering some kind of a different sort of method for housing immigrants or different facilities for housing immigrants. That's what we're talking about here?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Correct.
Now, the issue's been getting a lot of attention in Washington, Diane. I mean, House Republicans held a hearing last week and blamed President Obama's policies for the detention crisis. What are the state officials in Texas saying about that? Do they agree?
Some do. Some politicians do agree that there's the perception or the fact of lax immigration policies towards children, and that for they're coming because of that. There are others who say no, it's violence, and it's violence, and it's violence. People are fleeing for their lives. The UN, for example, is emphasizing that as well, that there's been a 700% increase in asylum applications to countries other than the United States.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about recent protests in California over the housing of undocumented immigrants. I'm speaking with Tatiana Sanchez of the Deseret News in California and Diane Solis of the Dallas Morning News in Texas. Of course, they've both been covering this issue from their respective regions. So, Tatiana, what about that? Talk a little bit more about this resource issue, if you would. Have the local officials been offered any resources to help them or to address their concerns here? Or did this all happen so fast? Those conversations don't seem to have taken place.
Mm-hmm. I think things have shifted a little bit. Originally, there was a lot of concern that these resources were going to be drained. Now, from what I'm hearing from local officials and things of that sort, is that Immigration and Customs Enforcement doesn't plan on using any local resources for these undocumented immigrants. Local officials have been told that it's all going to be taken care of in-house, sort of by the Border Patrol and by ICE. But I think that one of the concerns originally, particularly in Murrieta, was that, local officials weren't informed on what was going to happen, on how it was going to affect their town. And so I think that's a lot of the reason why that sudden panic set in, is because they were, thinking, well, we're not really equipped to be allotting these resources for such a large group of people to be coming into our town every 3 days.
Have those resources been forthcoming, or has that communication been straightened out to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, it's been straightened out. Like I said, certainly in El Centro, what ICE and what Border Patrol emphasized to the County Board of Supervisors and to local officials was that their resources would not be drained and would not be needed. However, local organizations, shelters, and things like that are still standing by, because the assumption is that at least a small group of these undocumented immigrants, once they are released, will need a bit of resources to, afford transportation, to see family and things of that sort, to leave the area.
So, Diane, President Obama is scheduled to visit Texas this week, but the White House says he's not planning to visit the border. I mean, the spokesman, Josh Earnest, said that, well, some people are suggesting, this is quoting in the New York Times here, the reason that some people are suggesting the president should go to the border when he's in Texas is because they want to play politics than actually trying to address some of these challenges. But what about that? I mean, is there a desire for him to, I don't know what you've been hearing about this, is there a desire for him to come to the border to see the conditions for himself? Or what are some of the officials saying down there about what they would like the president personally to do?
I think things have happened so quickly for some people in policy positions, and there's probably people who want the president to go down to the border, and there's probably people who think that it's a very bad idea politically. This is a critical week. We're hearing that there may be an effort in Congress to treat these unaccompanied children differently than they are right now, under certain asylum and trafficking victims protection laws. And already people who are in the immigrant rights community are coalescing and trying to move to make sure that key pieces of existing law stays in place that protects unaccompanied minors who come from non-contiguous countries and are screened more heavily for fears of persecution.
Before we go, Diane, can you tell us about, we talked a lot about advocates and activists and what they're doing, but what about people in other parts of the community, like the churches, and are they getting involved in this question?
Yeah, they are. I spent the weekend at a service for Latino immigrants, and I was quite impressed by what the pastor had to say about, as he put it, the suffering of the children. And he himself is from El Salvador, and he has a niece who's in North Texas in detention proceedings right now. So he knows the issue very well. He fled El Salvador, some 30 years ago because of the violence there. And I've also talked to a teacher in Grand Prairie, Texas, and she's getting ready to do whatever she can to help youngsters. She's a retired second grade teacher. Mm. She knows what kids need. So, and she says she's part of a list of people who want to help.
Diane Solis is a staff writer at the Dallas Morning News. With us from Dallas, Tatiana Sanchez is a reporter with the Desert Sun newspaper. She was with us from Palm Springs, California. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
We'll hear about the Wimbledon Championships in just a few minutes, but first, a very different story that touches on the world of sport. It's a story that's been dominating the news in South Africa, the trial of former track star Oscar Pistorius. Court watchers say that the trial may be coming to a close. You probably remember that he's the former Olympian who shot and killed his girlfriend, Riva Steenkamp, on Valentine's Day in 2013. He says it was a tragic accident, that he thought she was an intruder, but prosecutors say it was murder. We wanted to get the latest on the trial, so we've called once again on Barry Bateman. He's a senior reporter for Eyewitness News in South Africa, and he's been following the case closely. Barry Bateman, welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Only a pleasure. Hello.
Could you remind us of why there was this long break in the trial so that he could undergo a psychological evaluation? I think it's confusing to Americans because I think a lot of us would have assumed that this kind of psychological evaluation would have occurred before the trial commenced. So can you just tell us a little bit about that and if we know what the evaluation found?
Sure. It usually, when it comes to the law, it's the onus upon the defense team to offer a psychiatric reason for the trial not going ahead, or to challenge their culpability in terms of criminality. It was never the contention from the defense that Oscar Pistorius is not mentally liable, or he's not criminally liable for shooting his girlfriend. What happened when it came to this late stage of the trial, the defense team presented their own psychiatrist, Dr. Merrill Foster, who had diagnosed Pistorius with generalized anxiety disorder. It was the state then, on their interpretation of the Criminal Procedures Act, found that in the event that such evidence does exist or comes to light in a trial, then it is the duty of the court to then refer the accused for a psychiatric evaluation. So that's why it came so late in the case. It's usually the onus of the defense at the beginning if they are going to offer such a defense in the trial. It's not the case here. It's the evidence presented so late where the state felt that then it was the court's duty in terms of the law to compel the accused to go for this evaluation.
Tell us a little bit about what that means, or what was the upshot of all of that? Do we know?
Well, we came back. Remember, going into this, it was the defense witness who found that Oscar Pistorius had this generalized anxiety disorder, which may have impacted his judgment when he shot Riva Steenkamp. We've come back from this panel of experts who've evaluated him. What they have found, that he suffers from significant depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. These are both the result of post the shooting. As a result of the shooting, he suffers from these disorders. However, they found that there was no evidence to suggest that there was pre-existing generalized anxiety disorder, and at the current stage, he certainly does not present with any of the symptoms to be classified as suffering from this particular disorder. So his own defense psychiatrist's evidence prior to going for this evaluation has pretty much been overruled.
There were reports that the defense would rest today. Did that occur?
We were hoping for that. It came, they have called their last witness. Their last witness has been excused. Where we ended today was that the defense wanted to consult with the state psychiatrist. It was an application by the defense, which was ultimately overruled. It's not going to happen. So where we ended was a defense advocate, Barry Ruges, asking the court they wanted to adjourn early today just for one more night, just to, I suppose, go back and consult with their client and just to ensure that they have covered all the bases and there is no need to call any further witnesses. All indications are is that we'll wrap up tomorrow and we'll get those dates for closing argument.
As they move now to draft these closing arguments, could you just tell us what the key points are that you expect to hear from both sides? I'm particularly interested, though, if the prosecution presented a motive for why Pistorius would have intentionally, I believe, killed
That's the issue.
Woman.
I mean, for the benchmark for murder would be the intentional killing of the victim here. And we haven't got a motive, but they don't need a motive. I mean, it's obviously nice to have one, but unfortunately, they just don't have it. It is a circumstantial evidence-based case. And the state's case is that there was this fight late on the 13th of February that went on into the morning. This is supported by a neighbor who had heard arguments at 1 o'clock in the morning. They say that Reeva Steenkamp was up at that hour. This is also proven by the food that's in her stomach. We've got the defense pathologist, the state pathologist, testifying on the how quickly food is processed. And then, of course, the screams that were heard by the neighbors before those bangs in the early hours of the morning. That's the state's case, that there was this fight. Reeva fled in fear from Oscar Pistorius. She hid inside this bathroom, and in this fit of rage, he fired the four shots, which ultimately killed her.
And the
different story from the defense. Mm-hmm. What the defense will be arguing is there's two sets of noises. They're going to say the first set of noises was this... the gunshots, which killed Reeva Steenkamp. The screams that the neighbors heard, they saying was the screams of Oscar Pistorius calling for help. And that second set of noises, which the state says are the gunshots, they say are the cricket bat hitting the door where Oscar was trying to rescue his girlfriend. They say that Oscar Pistorius believed that his girlfriend, or he believed there was an intruder in his house, and that she had slipped away to the bathroom while he was bringing in a fan and closing the curtains to the bedroom. And ultimately, they're going to argue that it's a tragic accident and a case of mistaken identity, that he never intended to kill his girlfriend.
Now, of course, South Africa does not have a jury system, so the verdict will be down to the judge, Thoso Kizile Masipa. And do we have any indication of, has she shown us anything that would indicate how she seems to be leaning here?
Certainly not. I mean, we would go through it, and you could guess if you see on the certain objections that she might be ruling on in one particular day. But she certainly hasn't given a hint at all. Plus, I'd say it's still too early just yet to get an idea of where this is going. We still have these closing arguments, and it will be considerably detailed in the way they'll be submitted to the court. I think only once we get our hands on those and have a good study of what each party is presenting, they will wrap up all the evidence. I mean, I tried to do it now, but they will certainly wrap it all up together and put it to the court in a matter that would best explain their case. And I think once we get hold of those, we'll be able to have an idea of where this case is going.
Before we let you go, you know, there was a video leaked, apparently it was leaked this weekend, that shows Oscar Pistorius reenacting the night of the shooting, and it's been reported that this was illegally obtained. And could you just tell us a little bit about that? What's the relevance of this? Does this seem to have any impact?
Well, it certainly won't have any impact on the case. It wasn't raised in court today. But what this is it was Arnold Pistorius, Oscar's uncle. He almost has been the main go-to person in terms of the family and the representation and dealing with the lawyers. He was part of inviting this company called The Evidence Room, an Ohio-based company which deals in crime scene 3D recreation. Now, they came through to South Africa in October last year. They filmed Oscar Pistorius reenacting the night he shot Reeva Steenkamp. So he was walking on his stumps. He had his arm up in front of him as if holding his gun up. He was asked to scream. His sister Amy was playing the role of Reeva in a toilet at his uncle's house, where he went and collected her off the floor in the bathroom. He carried her downstairs, and this was all filmed. Now, this is the footage which was sold. So it was, we understand that the evidence room was shopping around for the highest bidder through several media houses. It just happened to be okay. The Australians that coughed up the most money. And this was sold to them for their big exclusive.
But never presented at trial. So this is officially not a part of the case at all. So.
No. Certainly. It is not part of the case. The defense says it was part of preparation, and it was never intended to be presented in court anyway.
All right. Barry, thank you so much for keeping us up to date here. Barry Bateman is a senior reporter for Eyewitness News in South Africa. He's also working on a book, Behind the Door, the Oscar and Riva story, with us from Pretoria. Barry, thank you once again.
Thank you very much.
Now we head to London, where the Wimbledon tennis tournament wrapped up on Sunday with Novak Djokovic beating former champ Roger Federer. On Saturday, Petra Kvitova beat out Eugenie Bouchard to earn her second Wimbledon title. It was a tournament with plenty of drama and upsets. Joining us to tell us more about that is Hugh Muir. He's an editor with The Guardian, and he covered Wimbledon for them. He's with us now from a studio at The Paper. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're absolutely welcome, Michelle.
So tell us about the final matches. Exciting.
We're absolutely, I mean, we're still in the glow of an absolutely wonderful Wimbledon championship. Two really brilliant finals. I mean, brilliant in different ways, because in the women's final with Petra Kvitova against Eugenie Bouchard, Kvitova having won her first title a couple of years ago, when she was then said to be the future of tennis and, you know, that she would dominate the women's game for a while. And she seemed to go off the boil and she had a real difficulty in coping with the fame that brought her, and so people were a little disappointed in her. And here she came back, and she was playing Eugenie Bouchard, who really broke through in this Wimbledon, mm-hmm. and people predict great things for her. And many people were expecting a close match, and Petra Kvitova played just the most perfect match. And then the men, just a great final again, because, you know, in one respect, tennis is soap opera. It's kind of soap opera with tennis balls and rackets and sweat thrown in. And in the men's final, you had two backstories. You had Roger Federer, who has got 17 titles. He's now 32, which is getting on a bit for someone playing at that level. And he's desperate to get at least one more Grand Slam. I compared it in a piece that we wrote to be like Muhammad Ali, when he had the rumble in the jungle. And everyone was saying, you know, you're too old, you should give it in now. And, you know, you'll hurt yourself. Don't have that last fight. And he did, and he won. I think Federer is kind of looking at that sort of trajectory, and so that was his holy grail, was one more slam. And he was against Novak Djokovic, the Serbian, who is a great player, a really dominant player at the moment, with the bugbear that of the last four Grand Slam finals he'd appeared in, he had lost three of them. And so psychologically, he was beginning to doubt himself and to whether he really was, you know, the kind of champion that he wanted to be and that everyone thought he would be. And so what they produced was an absolutely enthralling contest that went for five sets. And as we know, Djokovic came out on top, but Federer was mighty close.
So it sounds to me that you're saying that the excitement of the men's match wasn't even necessarily the physicality of it, but the emotion of it, the mental strength of
so
it.
Often,
is that it?
Yeah. So often in tennis, the backstory is what makes it exciting. And because you know why both of the players are trying to do what they're trying to do and how they're trying to do it, psychology is so important here.
You know, there were some early exits from big names, previous big names, like last year's men's winner, Andy Murray, the five-time women's champion, Serena Williams. Did that change the tenor of things? I mean, does that make things more exciting or less? I mean, sometimes, you know, people are looking forward to seeing these stars, and when they're not there, it sort of changes things. What effect do you think that had on the tournament?
Michelle, that was responsible for a lot of the buzz around Wimbledon, because, you know, we've all really enjoyed these players who've been at the top of the sport for so long, but you do want some change and you do want some unpredictability. And so, you know, certainly in Britain, when Andy Murray wasn't able to defend his title, we were very disappointed. But he lost to Grigor Dimitrov, who people call Baby Federer, because there are similarities between the very stylish, graceful way that Federer plays and the way that Dimitrov plays. He's box office as well, because he's the boyfriend of Maria Sharapova at the moment. And so what you kind of had was a dynamic whereby you had a lot of younger players beginning to assert themselves. And here you're thinking of Eugenia Bouchard, who I mentioned before, and Nick Kyrgios, the Australian who beat Rafa Nadal, and Dimitrov. And so these are players just coming through. And they were kind of saying to the old guard, look, you know, it's our time now. Why don't you move aside? And the old guard was saying, I don't think so.
I wanted to ask about the Williams sisters. Both Williams sisters were out in the third round. And then Serena seemed to be quite ill. They've been so critical to the sport in so many ways. Is the Williams era finished, in your view? And secondly, do you think that what they've brought to the sport will last, or is it just unique to them?
I think they've changed it, absolutely, because I think that the way that kind of power game, the way that they hit from the baseline, basically has been a template for a lot of other women players. And so I think that they, if there's a mold, I think that they created that mold. I worry more in the future for Venus, because she has been struggling and doesn't really look as if she has a path back to being to where she was. Serena's slightly different in that Serena, you can never really tell what the trajectory is, because one minute she'll have an absolutely fantastic tournament and no one will be able to get near her, and she'll win really quite easily. And then the next tournament, she'll go out quite quickly. And you then wonder, well, is that about focus? Is that because there are other things that she's doing? So you'll never be able to say of Serena, well, that's it. She's probably won her last tournament, because she can come back and just be a powerhouse in the next one.
You said that you think they've changed the sport. How so?
Well, I once saw them playing doubles, and I'd never seen doubles like it. I mean, doubles is really the real kind of British etiquette bit of the game, and the way they did it with the kind of just the power and the intensity. I mean, in a way, it was frightening. I was watching it through closed fingers. It was extraordinary. And so, you know, and I think that, you know, they've probably forced everyone to just become stronger, fitter, and certainly to forced everyone to play at a much higher level. Now, we can talk then about, you know, whether or not their backgrounds are important. And I hope that will be important, because, you know, no one gave them what they had. They came from quite ordinary backgrounds and fought their way to where they are. And I think you want to see a bit more of that in tennis. As I said, so much of tennis is about backstory. Mm. And when you know that, you know, that people have had to fight for it, when you know that Novak Djokovic in Serbia, well, you know, in his formative years, was during the war, and but I think he did a lot of practice in a swimming pool that had no water in it, and every time the bombers came over, they'd have to cover it up, and he'd have to run inside. You know, these are extraordinary. We see them now as very rich, successful sports people, but a lot of them have been through quite difficulties, and maybe that's why they are where they are. Maybe tennis is a very difficult attritional game in many ways. It's very hard to keep your level of intensity. It's very hard to travel the world and to produce your best when you don't quite feel as well as you might. So I think it takes for certain qualities and a certain durability, and maybe people who've had to fight their way up from a difficult start make for better tennis players. Maybe that's what we should be looking for in this country, where, as you know, we yearn for champions. We have Andy Murray now, a very good example. He wasn't very well to do. He's from an ordinary from Dunblane, an ordinary town in Scotland. But from day one, from the first time you saw him, you just realised that he had a real fire and a real intensity about him, and I suspect that's had a lot to do with his success.
Hugh Muir is an editor with The Guardian newspaper in England. He was kind enough to join us from a studio there. Hugh Muir, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to hear from one of the biggest voices in American theater, Audra McDonald. Last month, she racked up her 6th Tony Award for her role as Billie Holiday in Lady Day Emerson's Bar and Grill. That means she is now the most decorated actress in Broadway history. Apart from Broadway, though, she's also a recording artist in her own right. Last year, she released an album called Go Back Home, and when I spoke with her about it, I noticed it had been 7 years since her previous album. So I asked her why she waited so long.
I had tried a couple of times over the past 7 years to get an album out, and I just wasn't, it wasn't coming, you know, it wasn't coming. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do an album until I have something to say. And when I look back on that now, I realize it's because life was happening and I was living life. And sometimes some people say, you know, as a performer, you go out and you give everything you have on stage or whatnot, and then you have to go and fill up again. And, you know, for good and for bad, I think life filled me up again. When I started putting songs together, it happened very quickly. A lot of it was songs that I had been singing for a while and had never recorded, like The Glamorous Life and Some Days. And others were songs that I had just learned from these wonderful crop of new composers who are out there, new musical theater, just wonderful stuff that I think I'd love to get out to the public. And then it all sort of started to take on the theme of, a very personal theme of sort of, I think songs that I were drawn to were songs or things sort of like that had been happening in my life over the past 7 years, like being away from home or being away from my daughter, and then kind of ending with Make Someone Happy, which is just sort of where my life has come after losing my father and plane crash and going through a divorce and then remarriage and, you know, sort of the reemergence of a happier, maybe more seasoned, for sure, person.
Well, you know, it is true that you have a lot to say in this album. I'm just going to play a little bit from Married Love.
Married love, married love, here's my strategy of married love. If it seems your hopes are growing dim, don't forget that you chose me. So he must be wonderful, right?
If that song is it's a wonderful song written by Michael John Lacusa, and it was written for a one-woman musical that he's written called ABC, which is based on a book by Marlene Dietrich. And in that book, it's basically, some people refer to it as Marlene Dietrich's dictionary. She just goes through the alphabet and just has random words for each letter of the alphabet and then her thoughts on those particular words. And one of those words is married love. And a lot of it is just sort of her musings and her thoughts on marriage and her thoughts on partnership and relationships and how we as women must sort of do what we must do to be in relationships. You know, mind you, this was written, you know, in the 50s. And it's not necessarily specific personal experience of my own, but just the whole institution of marriage and everything that it brings about and everything that it tests in a person.
Go back to a time before you learned how to mate and then humiliate and when to delegate the blame. You were young and felt your love and it was wonderful. He noticed that you loved him and yes, he was.
You know what? I was thinking about our conversation and listening to the album. One word kept coming to mind over and over again. And the word that came to mind for me was raw. This album has so many raw feelings and ideas in it. I mean, it just... And even the way you talk about it in the liner notes, about why you chose each song. I mean, the song about, you know, The Glamorous Life, which is a song about, you know, a little girl thinking about her mom who's an actress. Mm-hmm. And you are a mom who is an actress and a performer, and you have a daughter. That's raw. And I just...
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, did it feel raw when you were putting this together?
Absolutely. And these are certainly songs that feel raw when I sing them. Songs, like I said, that I have a deep personal connection to.
Let's just play a little bit of The Glamorous Life.
Ordinary mothers lead ordinary lives. Keep the house and sweep the parlor. Mend the clothes and tend the children. Ordinary mothers, like ordinary wives, make the beds and bake the pies and wither on the vine. That mine. Dying by inches every night, what a glamorous life. Brought on by winches, to recite, what a glamorous life. Ordinary mothers never get the flowers, and ordinary mothers never get others couldn't, cough for hours maintaining their pores.
Quite literally, I say this over and over about this album. If someone were to write a Broadway show about my life over the past 7 years, this would be the soundtrack. It really would be. And which is probably why it ends up sounding a bit raw, because it's all, if not, you know, specific within the lyric, the idea of the themes that I'm exploring in this album are all very, very, very specific and personal and very fresh.
Ordinary mother strive on, being private, and ordinary mother somehow can survive it, but ordinary mothers never. No, they're just standing still with the kettles to fill while they're missing the thrill of the glamorous.
I do want to say I'm sorry about your dad. I
mean, oh, thank you. That was hard.
Under any circumstances, I mean, losing a dad is hard. A plane crash. I mean, your dad was a pilot and as well. And I
It was really difficult, and it happened so, you know, just on a bright sunny day in California, and they still really don't know what caused the crash. And it was a bright sunny day in New York, and I just finished doing a matinee of 110 in the Shade, and I got this phone call from my stepmom saying, your dad's gone, you know. And so I realized it really was the catalyst that sort of forced a lot of change in my life. And going through that trauma and grief and learning how to mourn and realizing that I was mourning, it changes you. It really does.
How do you think it changed you?
I started to take stock in my life really quickly and look at my life and say, okay, who am I? What do I really want? What am I missing? What do I need? Because I realize that life is short, and it's easy to kind of get cocky and forget about that, you know, when you're young and just sort of trapezing about your life and doing what you got to do, and then something like that happens, and especially when it's, you know, my dad was, you know, 6'6" and strapping huge guy. I mean, just, you know, there was no better picture of like a big, healthy 62-year-old man, and you know, he lifted weights every day. To lose that sort of security, you know, I lost my daddy. I lost the person who I think, if you know, if something really were wrong and I really needed help and I needed him to beat up someone for me or whatever, you know, as a little girl, losing your daddy, all of a sudden that was gone. So it forced me to look at life and try and live it more presently and more fully and more honestly and for better purpose.
Which is why I don't know how you get through I'll Be Here. I don't know how you get through it. It's from Ordinary Days, a play which is inspired by 9/11.
Some days I don't get through it, I have to say. Some days when I'm singing it, I don't get through it. You know, for me, it certainly has a personal meaning in terms of losing my father really quickly. But also, it's kind of a tribute to my stepmom, watching my stepmom have to, like, get her life back together and find her life too, losing the love of her life, and then all of a sudden just like, how do I move on, and watching her deal with that and try and pick up the pieces. And there's some very specific lines in that correlate directly to her, like, take off my ring and you let yourself smile, you know, all those things that I've watched her go through and thought, well, that that's why this song, I think, you know, resonates with me.
It's such a beautiful song. I hate to give people, and it tells such a story, and I hate to give people, but I just want to play a little bit of it, even though I feel bad because I'm not doing it justice by playing a clip of it, but here's just a little bit.
I don't mean to ruin your evening by bringing up all of this stuff. You're probably wondering why I even called you tonight. Well, today something happened that spooked me, all right. I saw this storm cloud of papers fall down from the sky, and I thought of that day, and I started to cry. When sure as I breathe, I heard John clear as day, saying, hey, you're allowed to move on, it's okay, because I'll be here, even if you decide to get rid of my favorite sweater. Even if you go out on my birthday this year, instead of sitting at home, letting all of life's moments pass by, you don't have to cry. because I'll be here when you start going back to the places we went to together. When you take off my ring and you let yourself smile, when you meet someone handsome and patient and true, when he says...
It is remarkable, isn't it, that something so beautiful can come out of something so ugly, which is like a lot of your work, like Porgy and Bess, for example, right? It's so beautiful, and yet it's about a lot. There's ugliness in it, you know.
Yeah,
there's
so much
personal
pain.
Ugliness, yeah. Pain, racism. Mm-hmm. It's about, mm-hmm. you know, so many things. I was curious about that. When you think about the beauty of your instrument and what you're using it for, and then the kinds of stories you want to tell. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm just wondering how you think about that.
Well, for me, you know, the way I've been drawn to music has always been something that moves me and something that sort of reflects something that I want to say or something that I feel or something that I believe in, or story-driven things especially. And so the voice is very important, but the meaning behind the voice and, you know, just the fact that you use the voice as the means to communicate the story, the feeling, the whatever, that's what's most important to me, which is probably why I didn't connect so well in the operatic world, because I was always willing to sacrifice the sound if it, you know, made a moment better. And that's not, I mean, what is done in opera, and I love opera, and I wish I could do it, but it's a different thing in opera where, you know, the voice, the beauty of the voice is what's most important, you know.
The theater has been a home for you and has been good to you. Do you think the theater is doing what it should be doing for our society? Is it telling the stories that it needs to tell?
Yes. I think if you look everywhere that there's theater, I think if you look just on Broadway, then you won't necessarily see all the stories that are needing to be told, because they're not all there. I mean, for many reasons, whether it's, you know, commercial or they're... I don't think it's that they're not being written, because I think they are being written, but they're not being brought to that huge, visible commercial level. You know, and all the wonderful work that's being done in underground theaters and off-Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theaters all around the country, it's there. It absolutely is there. And as it has been since, you know, the ancient Greece, I mean, it's there, and it's commenting on society and commenting on human nature and whatnot. I think it's absolutely there. It's just maybe not necessarily in the most commercial and visible places that we would like it to be.
That was singer and six-time Tony Award-winning actress Audra McDonald. And finally, it's time for the feature we call In Your Ear. That's the part of the program where we ask some of our guests what they're listening to these days. But as this program winds down, our last broadcast is scheduled for August 1st. We thought it would be nice to hear what members of our staff are listening to and what they like to have playing as they work out or chill out or put the show together. So let's hear what the big boss, our executive producer, Carlene Watson, has on her playlist.
I'm Carlene Watson, and what's playing in my ear is Chuck Brown's Jingle Jangle. I love Chuck Brown. Chuck Brown is the music of DC. Chuck Brown is Mr. Go-Go. Let me show you how to get your freak on. Already got it on, we got this. First you gotta get into the freak zone. Already in the zone, we got this. And then the lady's gonna get the hips on. It's the thing that I go to when I really want to get jazzed for my workout. Love Chuck telling me how to move my hips. It's a great piece of music.
Dread, natty dread now. Dread la conga bongo.
The other thing that's playing in my ear is Bob Marley. I am a Jamaican. I am a proud Jamaican. Jamaica is my happy place. And when I want to go to my happy place, a little bit of Bob Marley gets me there faster than the plane ride to Jamaica.
And don't stay there and just or the battle will be hotter. And you won't get no supper.
Naughty Dread is an old, old Bob Marley song, and I just love the beats of that song.
Ever wonder about what he's doing? How it all turned to lies? Sometimes I think that it's better to never.
I love Pink. I've always loved Pink. Pink is sort of my bad girl. And whenever I'm feeling feisty, I play a little Pink. This song, Try, is a little anthemic, a little bit of encouragement, you know, you gotta try, try, try. I play that whenever I start to doubt that I can actually do some of the things that are required of me, and it always puts me in a better place.
Why do we fall in love so easy, even when it's not right?
That was Tell Me More executive producer Carlene Watson telling us what's playing in her ear.